Donald Jeffries Show.
Yeah, welcome to the Donald Jeffries Show. I have a very special guest tonight. Paul Schrade is just a real living reminder of history. He was the president of United Auto Workers Local, one time a longtime union and labor activist. He was the head of labor for Robert F. Kennedy's 1968 presidential campaign, worked closely with him, was friends with Robert F. Kennedy. And more importantly, from our standpoint at this point, he was actually in the Ambassador Hotel and was one of the shooting victims that night. And he has been an activist in trying to get the truth out about the assassination for a very long time. And I'm just delighted to have him. Mr. Schrade, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. Good to be here and good to have this opportunity to talk about this issue, because it's a really big issue right now, particularly since the New York Times has just published a statement which is totally off the wall by one of the Kennedy family members, by Rory, who should know, but I don't know where she gets all this stuff.
What did she say? Because I mean, I like her. She did such great work on those documentaries on Appalachia. It's sad to hear. What did she say?
Well, there's so much in there. You've got to read the whole thing on the air.
Okay.
Rush to talk about it, but she makes the case that it was Sirhan. It was not a second gunman, and she's totally wrong and doesn't know it. The problem is with Rory, with Joe, and a couple of other, and also, let's see,
Carrie,
Joe,
Kennedy,
Carrie, and Rory, they don't want to talk about it, and yet they do talk about it, and they're totally wrong with what they're saying, and that's really disturbing, because we can't get to the case with that kind of problem with family members, but we're going to. The case is so different from what they're saying. Robert Kennedy was not murdered by Sirhan. He tried, but he failed, and somebody else did it, and we have forensic evidence that shows two different guns firing, two different positions, and that is not known or understood or rejected by Rory and Joe, the two major spokesmen, and Kerry, the three major spokespersons for the family on that side of the issue.
Yeah, it's very sad to hear. And Joe was in Congress for a long time, and a huge difference between him and his brother, RFK Jr., obviously. But I don't, and we get this, the Kennedy family has I mean, I've investigated the JFK assassination since I was a teenager in the mid-70s. I worked with Mark Lane, Citizens Committee of Inquiry, as a teenage volunteer. He was my hero. And, I've never understood at that time, and even then, the Kennedy family has always been strange about not wanting to talk about the assassinations, not wanting to know. And yet you have the Martin Luther King's family, who was out front and center. Dexter King, Coretta Scott King, went and testified at James Earl Ray's trial. Why, I don't understand, and that's why RFK Jr. is so refreshing, that he has been willing to talk about it. But I think what we're seeing here with Rory and Joe Jr. is kind of the legacy, really, that goes back to Jackie, where it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell. And I've never understood it, because it was my loved one. I would want to get to the bottom of it. Do you understand that attitude?
No, it's not a question of don't ask, don't tell. They're telling.
Well, yeah,
the wrong
this case.
Story.
Yeah, well, this, I guess that is different, because
I'm not asked about the evidence.
Yeah, yeah, that's. It's, I mean, and they should want to know about the evidence more than anyone else. It should mean more to them than that. And again, I'm really disappointed in Rory, because Joe, I don't, he was kind of an.
This is 52 years later. Yeah. And they still don't understand what really happened, and they reject any opportunity to understand it. They don't listen. I tried to convince Joe and Joe Jr. I tried to convince Carrie. She came at me one day here a year or so ago. We were in the same meeting, and came up laughing. I'm not going to talk about it, Paul. It's not funny to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't understand. So you've talked to them, you know them, you've tried, and so you're even,
No.
they're not persuaded by your personal experiences having been there and been a shooting victim yourself.
That's right. They don't listen. They don't want to talk.
That's very sad to hear. Well, let's go back to June 4th, 1968. Robert F. Kennedy has just won the California primary, the crown jewel of the primary process. It looks like he's the clear favorite now to sweep to the nomination and probably the presidency. So there's this you're there, and there's this air of triumph. We've seen the video, and everybody celebrating
Well, it
and
wasn't
dancing.
early, that air of triumph wasn't there early. In fact, I was voted and was with the president of my union, Walter Reuther, reopened negotiations with McDonnell Douglas on a new contract, and flew up north for a meeting with Einar Stone the vice president of the Teamsters Union. And I flew back, and I was not going down because victory parties are always a problem for me. There's too much drinking and noise and smoke, and I just think it would be great to go home and be happy about the victory. But my car radio, as I headed home a couple of miles from the hotel, I just found out we were behind. I said, I better go down there. And because this is going to be a terrible night. And got there, and somebody came up to me and said, Bob heard you were here. And I found out then that we were winning. And so the whole night changed for me and for everybody else. And we spent time together on the fifth floor. The whole fifth floor was taken over by the Kennedy family and staff, and every room was filled. All the media were there. A lot of friends. It was just a joyous, joyous occasion.
Well, I guess, and then then obviously it all turns dark very quickly. So how you're at what point, you describe at what point you were shot, where you were shot, how it related to what you saw in terms of, did you see RFK get shot, and what you saw, were you, did you see Sirhan, did you see anything else? What were your personal observations?
Well, after Bob's very brief speech with 1,500 and 1,000 limit ballroom, with another ballroom down below with the Farm Workers Union people, I actually went to the pantry area because that is a corridor we came down and to the ballroom for the speech. And so I waited at the pantry door. Well, Bob came in alone, and that really surprised me and shocked me because he shouldn't be traveling alone. But he had been behind the stage on a lower level where a couple of his guys were watching a television set and cluing him in on what the media was saying at that point. And so he just dashed into the pantry alone. He went up and shook hands with Jesus Perez and Juan Romero, the busboy, and a very famous guy now, although he died recently. And he was shaking hands with them. And he said to me at that point, I want you and Jess Unruh with me at the press conference, because Jess was chairman of the campaign. I was the labor chair. And so I turned around, saw Jess and asked him, come on, Jess, Bob wants us with him. And I was about 8 feet behind Bob at that point, and all of a sudden the television lights were on. NBC and CBS were there, and those lights blinded me, and I all of a sudden started shaking and fell. I thought I was being electrocuted, but I found out later that, well, sooner after that I was shot in the head.
Gee, so obviously you came out of that okay. So it wasn't a I guess it was a kind of a glancing blow or something. But so were you aware the entire time as you shot in the head that You're aware of what's going on?
I can't go on the floor, and there's a doctor behind me holding my head, and I was bleeding pretty bad.
Okay.
In fact, just before that, a friend of mine from a different union had seen me and put one of the boater hats, campaign hats, over my face because he thought I was dead. But he did check my pulse and found out that. So he put the hat under my head. It was just bleeding on that hat. So those were the kind of significant things that were happening at that particular moment. Well, the doctor behind me said, you know, you're going to be okay. We're taking you to the LAPD hospital. Every shooting victim went to the LAPD, had its own, the police had its own hospital. And I said, but I'm a member of the Kaiser Plan. And he says, he laughed and he says, I'm a doctor from Kaiser, you're ours, we'll get you there. Well, another incident, I didn't know, you know, that Bob had been shot at that point. I was at a different place on the floor. And the medics came in again and took a look at Billy Wiesel from ABC TV out of Washington and said, he's a goner. And they left. But then they came back soon after. And he's still alive. They said, and so they said, we'll get you to the hospital. I said, well, take him to Kaiser with me. So he wound up at Kaiser at the same time, a different corridor and that sort of thing, called in and was able to do an interview. So there's all these strange kind of incidents still in my head that night. But at some point, I found out that Bob had been shot. And but I didn't know he had died until Walt Ruther, the president of my union, visited me in the hospital and told me that. And I just turned away from him and wept pretty badly for a long time. It was a terrible shock.
Oh,
I never got over it.
Oh, a lot of people felt that way. And I don't know if you've ever heard the song by Jon Stewart, The Last Campaign. He was, mm-hmm. Just it's beautiful, haunting. A lot of us felt that way. That was kind of the last gasp of the 1960s, and you know, the idealism died after that because so many people. I mean, it became so obvious to so many that I was a little kid. But why am I hearing? I'm hearing a big echo. Okay,
I'm at Don. I'm finally on.
Laurie. Okay. Okay.
I'm sorry, but I had a huge thing, but I'm finally on.
Well, that's great. I let me introduce real quickly Laurie Dusek, who just had some Skype issues and we finally got connected. She was Sirhan's attorney for many years. And I know Paul Schrade is very fond of her. So she's here as well. So we've been talking to Paul about what happened that night. So why don't you, Laurie, just give your impressions of what happened really last week that I think shocked all of us when Sirhan won at least an initial victory at his parole hearing.
Well,
hi, Laurie.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
You're
one of my favorite people in the world. And in solidarity, we will stand. I was rather shocked by the response by the parole board, but I was pleased. Am I optimistic that the governor is going to sign off on it, whether it's Newsom or whoever replaces him, if he does get replaced? No, I'm not. And that saddens me very much because Sirhan has served 53 years behind bars. He's been a model prisoner. He's got no infractions since 1972. He was stabbed 2 years ago. And, you know, if there's going to be justice has to be applied evenly across the board.
Absolutely. Well, Paul was talking about the New York Times article that Rory Kennedy wrote and Joseph Kennedy III, I guess, the former congressman, his comments as well, where they've come out, you know, strongly against Sirhan being released, the man who killed our father. What is that? How much is it going to put? I mean, I just can't imagine any politician going. And I, you know, I wish Sirhan the best, but I don't hold that much confidence in Gavin Newsom or Larry Elder or whoever's in there. Do you think that their comments are going to be are going to persuade, maybe tip the scales?
I don't know if they're going to persuade, but I think they might. They're going to have an impact. And what really bothers me, and Paul, please interject and tell me if I'm wrong. What really bothers me is that Carrie Kennedy, and I understand that she was very young when her father died. And I don't know how I would have felt if my dad had been taken away from me when I was that young. But Carrie Kennedy is the leader of the Robert Kennedy Human Rights Organization. And when you see President Biden in the White House and in the Oval Office, you see usually behind his right shoulder is a bust of Robert Kennedy. I don't understand how Carrie Kennedy could be standing out for injustice and prison reform, this, that, and whatever, and yet when it comes to something that is so wrong, but unfortunately so close to her, it doesn't apply. Sirhan was in isolation for 6 years after the 9/11 incident. And 9/11, 20 years ago. So Sirhan was already under the guidance or control of the California prison. So why did they think he had anything to do with 9/11 and put him in solitary confinement for 6 years? This is something that is his rights have been violated from day one. And I am shocked. Look, I went with Robert Kennedy Jr., and I have to say I have a lot of respect for him as far as his being able to meet with Sirhan. And he came in, he was very knowledgeable, he was this, he was that. And he shook his hand and he said, "I know you did not kill my father." It was an incredible, incredible interview, and I know Paul had a lot to do with that. I know Paul steered him that way. I don't understand how the Kennedy children, and again, my dad died at an old age, but I don't understand how they can say that they respect their father and their father. I mean, RFK is my hero. And I would not be representing Sirhan if I thought he would be guilty. I would not. I don't understand how they can be so-called religious people and then also support their father, who was, in my epitome, the best statesman that this country's had in the last 50 or 80 years. Equality and justice goes for everybody, and Sirhan deserves equality and justice as well. And do we send people to jail to rot, or do we send them to jail so that they can be reformed and released? And as Douglas Kennedy said, if he's not a threat to himself or to society, why should he remain beyond in prison?
Right, exactly. Well, Paul, just to get, because I wanted to have Laurie put her two cents in, but get back to, let's, and we'll get up to you.
I'm glad she mentioned the bust, because right behind me is a bust of Robert Kennedy, not the same one, but it, and I raise it because of this, that bust was given to me by Ethel Kennedy when we dedicated the RFK Community Schools to him several years ago. And at that time, the family was very generous in their statements about me, because we spent 20 years taking that Ambassador Hotel property away from Donald Trump, who said they took it away from me like Nazi Germany. And we took that Ambassador Hotel down, and we've got a beautiful school with 4,200 students, mostly Latino, because they're mostly Central American immigrants. And at that time, Carrie and and Kathleen and Bobby and Max were also generous in their thanks to me for getting that done. It took 20 years to organize that, but we did something that to establish the legacy of Robert Kennedy, and to then now face them when they're ignorant about what really happened that night, and not only ignorant, but refuse to understand, refuse to listen. They won't even listen to me about this case. And I've worked on it for over 30 years or more, that where Alan Lowenstein told me something was difficult about the evidence, and they won't listen. That's the problem.
Well, Paul, you know what really disturbs me, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this publicly, but really what disturbs me the most is that there's forgiveness. And again, I've not suffered, I've not gone through what these people have gone through. But you go to jail and you're supposed to serve your time, and then again you're supposed to, I just don't understand that their lack of forgiveness and acceptance. And it goes against their religious beliefs, and it goes against everything that their father stood for. As Robert Kennedy Jr. said to me after he met with Sirhan, he said, my father was the top law enforcer in this country, and he would be so disturbed as to what was happening to Sirhan.
Yeah, he sure would have been.
No, well, Paul, what you mentioned Ethel, who is still alive. How did you ever over the years that what were I mean I you know she's you know commending you on your work and everything, but they had to know that you were becoming very active in circles and with the second gun circles and saying Sirhan couldn't been responsible for firing the fatal shot because of the autopsy findings and so
they
forth.
They either didn't listen to that or rejected it. That's the problem.
Okay.
So look, may I interject?
Sure.
How many people read the autopsy reports of their family members? Very few people do. And when I met with Bobby Kennedy Jr. and went to see Sirhan, it was very awkward at times when he asked me questions. And I said to him, when your father won the primary that night, it didn't matter what entrance he left, he was going to be killed. I can't imagine his children wanting to read this. And I think they were probably sheltered and protected from this in many, many ways. And unfortunately, it's wrong, because especially for somebody like Kerry Kennedy, who's running an institution that says that therefore prison reform, human rights, etc. Well, again, Sirhan deserves those rights. And charity starts at home.
Well, unfortunately, into the Kennedy family, have you looked at some of the recipients of the the Profiles in Courage Award from the Kennedy Library? George H.W. Bush, Gerald Ford. A lot of us in the research community just said, okay, I don't know what's going on there. So that's why RFK Jr. is such a refreshing change of pace here. He's really out front and center on a lot of important issues, I think. But
if you notice that Kathleen didn't say anything, but she was the only offspring of the senator that didn't say anything. But if I'm not mistaken, Paul, she made a comment in 2018 that she thought that the investigation should be reopened.
Yes, she did. But that was after we confronted her, as I had to do with Bobby Jr. at one point, taking a position that an Arab killed my father, which said after when she was in Israel. And we had a conversation about that, and she finally understood that. And that's when she became a supporter of what we're trying to do in reopening the case. So it's been an education process for Bobby and her, because they were both that way. Ethel, at one point, there's a long story about how it got there, but Bobby wrote a book about the family, and in there he quotes Ethel saying, "I'm pleased that we were opposed to death penalty for Sirhan, because if he'd been killed that way, it would have been very damaging to our own position and how we feel religiously." She made a very strong, that's not the right statement I'm quoting, but she made a very strong statement about the fact that it was good that the family stood up for against the execution of Sirhan.
And, right. Senator Ted Kennedy had sent a letter asking on behalf of the family that he not be executed.
Yeah. And Ethel made a comment about it, saying, you know, that's really important to our own religious beliefs.
But Ethel, anyway, yeah, go ahead.
The family's been there at a certain time, certain ways, but it's very disturbing to me, and I'm disturbed every hour right now about Joe and about Carrie, and also Rory. I'm really pleased with Rory. She did a great interview with her mother. She was spent time at the school with us. Kathleen was one of the first people to come out in favor after we had problems with the family getting approval on tearing down the ambassador and building a school on that property, because they had certain emotional problems about that. But we got through that, and you know, the problem with Rory, I just don't understand her at this point. She's never been that vocal and determined about this. That's my real problem with the family members who are who are not understanding the fact that their father was killed by another person, and we don't know who he is yet, and to send Sirhan based upon evidence that was manufactured in the crime lab of the LAPD, and using that to convict Sirhan and sending him to the gas chamber. That is criminal activity upon the part of the LAPD and the DA, and it continues today, because the chief of police wrote a letter saying that Sirhan should not be released and that he's still guilty. You know, so we've got a problems with the establishment here. Fortunately, I have a really great lawyer who used to be the assistant, not the assistant, but the held a very important federal position in the court system. So he's really working on this case with me, and so I have a lot of difficulties dealing with all of these issues now at my age. So, but I'll get over it and get through it.
You know, Paul, the thing that bothers me the most about this is you and I both believe that Sirhan did not kill the senator.
Not only believe, we know he didn't.
We know. Okay.
Belief question. You sound like the journalist.
We've read the autopsy report. We've read the facts. But again, as I stated earlier, you would not expect family members to read an autopsy report. So setting that aside, you would think, and again, I've not lost a parent at a young age by violence. But you would think after somebody's been in jail for 53 years and they've served their time and he's gotten no violations since 1972, and Sirhan was stabbed 2 years ago, and I saw Sirhan within 48 hours after he was stabbed, and he had an 8 or 9 inch gash on the left side of his neck, and he was in bad shape. They didn't want to let me in. It was Labor Day weekend, but I got in. That man has gone through so much. And again, he deserves justice. And when you send somebody to prison, do you send them to prison so they can die there, or do you try to rehabilitate them? Or and then when the prosecution and the defense, Dan Brown, psychologists say he's not a threat to himself or anybody, shouldn't he be released? Why should the public be paying for him to be kept behind bars? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, we have in comments in the chat room about 53 years, even if he was guilty, is a long time. I don't know how long the average, you know, murderer serves, but I think obviously
if he had killed Robert Francis instead of Robert Francis Kennedy, yes, he would have been paroled in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I mean, can I say that?
He was up for parole in the 80s, and the district attorney at that time said, no, I'm not going to agree to that because we lost all of the great things that Robert Kennedy would do. So it was a terrible position to take. That was Van de Kamp. But he was up for parole, and they were going to, the parole board was actually going to do it back in 82 or 84. I forget the date, but it's on the record someplace. And, you know, that was, you know, something that really is very disturbing about the system, that the system and the Kennedy family members who are against Sirhan being paroled and kept in jail are in the same position. And it's very, you know, I'm very disturbed by all this, as you can
so
understand.
So am I. You know, and Paul, when I saw Sirhan within 48 hours after he had been stabbed, they had wanted to keep him in the hospital, but he was so frightened by being in a hospital room because he was being surrounded by policemen with guns, and he asked to be transferred back to the prison. When he got back to the prison, his room, his cell had been ransacked. His personal photographs had been destroyed. His books had been thrown away, and only one or two other inmates saved some of his property. And so this man has gone through a hell. And whether he's innocent or guilty, and again, I believe he's innocent, 53 years in prison, what are we doing? Is it in prison to reform people? Or are we just going to stick people there till they die? 77 years old, stabbed 2 years ago. He works in the prison's kitchen. At 77 years old, how long do they keep you working in the prisons? Do they keep you working until you drop dead? And that's not right.
No, it's not. Well, Paul, just to get back to it, and I'm sure probably everybody in the audience has an idea that there was a conspiracy and it wasn't just Sirhan, but go over what the process was for you.
Don't give me that conspiracy stuff. that takes us out of the realm of evidence.
Right.
And I've always avoided that, even though some of his attorneys have not. Right. It's a very dangerous area to get into because then they say, oh, you're just a conspiracy nut. No, I'm a nut about the evidence.
Right.
And has to be done. And none of his attorneys have done this except the attorneys now are actually operating on a different theory about why he should be released, not based upon the fact that a second gunman murdered him and not Sirhan. And that's why we have to focus on that constantly and not get into these silly conspiracy ideas or anything else about him. He didn't do it, and somebody else did, and then we've got to concentrate on that.
Okay, but I'm saying from when you started you're looking into it, I assume you originally thought he shot him because you were then shot you. But I mean, when you started being obviously convinced by doing your own research, or maybe somebody that was at Vince Bugliosi was out there, Robert Vaughn, the actor, and a lot of people were involved early on, I know, in you know, researching that. But
the person that actually got me involved was Allard Lowenstein.
Allard Lowenstein, yes.
A very close friend of Robert Kennedy's. And he came to me and said, you know, there's something else in this. He came to my home, and we went down. He says, there are people in your neighborhood that know something about this. We went down to Lillian Castellano's house.
Yes, yes.
With Floyd Nelson, and they had a picture of two bullet holes in the door frame behind Kennedy, which was evidence there was a second gunman.
Yeah.
And so from that point on, we started working on the case. That was the evidence that proved that there was a second gun.
And of course, in the autopsy report, of course, of Dr. Noguchi, who they tried to oust him from office because he didn't back down.
They did oust him from office for, I believe, 9 months or so, and then he fought it and he was reinstated. But they also tried to get Noguchi to change his testimony in the grand jury trial. And when he said that the bullet that killed Robert Kennedy was from a quarter of an inch to a half an inch from behind the right ear at an upward trajectory, somebody afterwards, and I'm sorry, I forget the name at the moment, but they pulled him aside and said, don't you want to restate what you said? And Noguchi said, no, I stand by what I said.
That was the forensic deputy district attorney, John Meyer, who just
died.
That's
right. Myers was it. That's correct, Paul.
Got the word from the Good Samaritan Hospital that Bob had died. He set up the autopsy for the at the hospital because of the big crowds around there that would have gone downtown and kind of messed things over. But John Meyer is the guy that set up the operation that next day, the day that Bob died, to take a gun out of storage, refire three bullets and match them against the only three bullets in evidence, and which was used at the grand jury the next day, quickly called. Here there wasn't even a funeral yet and no investigation of the case, and they were taking this guy and the grand jury indicting him based upon, you know, evidence that they made the day before. And it's such important criminal conduct on the part of the district attorney and also the full support from the LAPD to convict this guy and send him to the gas chamber. He was convicted on the phony evidence that was made by the LAPD.
Absolutely. Well, we got a couple questions in the chat room. First of all, for you, Paul, what is the hardest evidence, in your opinion, that undermines the official conclusion? And do either of the guests have any comment about Ted Sharrock's documentary, Second Gun?
The main evidence is that the gun that was used to kill Robert Kennedy was a Harrington Richard 22. And the second gunman, who we don't know yet, was firing federal bullets. Sirhan fired two bullets towards me and Kennedy. I got the first shot. The second shot, Sirhan missed Kennedy. He was then captured and thrown up against the steam table by Carl Euchre, the real hero that night, and pushed Sirhan over the steam table and flattened him out, and about 10 guys piled on. Sirhan's hand was being pounded on the steam table. He fired six more bullets after the first two. He wounded four other people, Goldstein, Stroll, Evans, woman, and one other, Wiesel, four with five bullets. That's the first two bullets When at me and Kennedy. That's five more bullets we can account for. That's seven bullets fired from an eight-shot Ivor Johnson 22. Two different guns, two different positions, two different bullets. That's the core of the evidence that's there on the record.
Well, the core of the evidence is the autopsy report by Noguchi. I mean, it is the most detailed autopsy report. They sent people from Washington, D.C.
No, the important evidence, there were two guns firing, two different people. The autopsy evidence is important to understand that Bob was shot at very close range by a
Correct.
Second gun.
And it couldn't have been by Sirhan. That's what I mean. Because Sirhan was never behind the senator, and he was never within less than an inch from behind the senator. And that's what Noguchi's right. report shows, that the bullets that shot the senator came from an upward trajectory from behind the senator and were within a quarter of an inch from where they were shot.
What about Ted Chirac's Second Gun documentary?
Excellent. One of the best sources of information there is.
He started it all.
Yeah, was that
it
so?
It was really great. I worked with Ted, and he was a very strange kind of guy to work with, but we had our arguments. But I think that documentary tells a lot that that's very helpful in dealing with this case.
I only met Ted Chirac once, and unfortunately, it was towards the end of his life. I believe he's responsible for opening up this case.
Yeah, and we're talking about what's happening now with the media and the fact that Rory Kennedy has a New York Times platform. This is where really you see the performance of the media and all these assassinations really hurts the cause of people who are arguing that we don't, you know, that these official narratives are wrong. So you guys are on my platform, the platform we have. We have these kind of platforms to argue against it and point out the evidence shows there were two guns. But how do you battle when, you know, if they're touting the official line, they can run to CNN, they can run to CBS, they can go to the New York Times. I don't think RFK Jr. is going to have those platforms, and we certainly wouldn't.
No, but I was very surprised that Douglas Kennedy, the youngest son, said anything. I was very surprised. How do we combat what they say? Again, they're talking about losing their father. And I can't say how that would feel. But justice is justice. And a lot of people in jail are fathers. And if you took their attitude that, well, daddy's not at Christmas and daddy's not here and daddy's not there, and I'm not saying this in disrespect to any of them because I'm not, but there are so many fathers that are in jail. So because you're a father and your child misses out on something means that you should never be paroled? I'm just flabbergasted and I don't understand. I just don't. And particularly Kerry Kennedy, who, again, is the head of the Robert Kennedy Human Rights Organization. I mean, if anybody should be on her case list, it should be Sirhan.
Absolutely. Well, I think we see the difference between not just the Kennedys today and the Kennedys in the past, but just the way society is. We've been transformed. I'm a classical liberal and a populist. I'm a civil libertarian. And that's the spirit of civil libertarianism, is even though you're violently opposed to someone or something, or in this case, they think he killed their father, still you kind of suspend that and you say, well, he has rights too. And I think very few people today can do that. And I think maybe some of that is in there, that they feel that there's not going to be pressure because that old civil libertarian left isn't there. Mark Lane, Nat Hentoff, these people aren't alive anymore. So I don't know who would argue there. Because, I mean, really, prison rights and things like that used to be a large part of the left's planks, platform back in the day. But I don't hear much talk about that now.
No, nor do I. He's 77 years old, and he's been behind bars for 53 years, and he's got a good record. He never had a crime before this. So he is – and he committed the crime, supposedly, at the age of 24, and he is now 77. So he fits under the both of being a youthful offender and an old offender, an older person. And he's been in jail for more than 20 years. So under the new parole laws, under California, he meets every criteria. Now, I'm going to say something. I'm not going to say who it was, but I got a text message from an assistant district attorney from California the other day after the announcement, and I got him a text message saying good news.
Yeah.
What's your
hello, Laurie?
Yes.
Yeah. You got a text message, and what did the
text
message?
I got a text message from a DA from California, telling me that she was amazed at the good news, but there are people within the system that support it. Can this person come out and publicly say that? No. But people that have seen him, I heard that three in prison guards wrote letters to the parole board, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
They have nothing to gain.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I remember, Laurie, you and I talked when you were on my other show last year, and and I know you were very nervous about, and I don't think, you know, you had high hopes for it, and I certainly didn't. So I'm really shocked that this happened. That we're even in the position of waiting for the governor, but it's interesting, and it would be nice if we had a media where you had investigative journalism, where maybe we'd see some articles out there on, well, you know, what are the controversies here? Why are so many people like Paul Schrade, who was a shooting victim, why are they fighting for this guy? After all, if they showed that, I think, you know, people would, but we just don't see that. The media doesn't do that.
No, and not only does media not do that, but the media was responsible in helping cover up what happened in 1968.
Absolutely.
There was a travesty of justice, and the media, they saw Sirhan and they pushed that. And I don't know who said what to them or whatever, but there was no question about, was there somebody else? They said, we have the killer, and this is him, and they put it on the front page of every newspaper. Now, I don't know of any other killing where, let's say if it had been a killing someplace else, where the press would have gone right away and said, this is the killer. Don't you arrest them first, and then they have a process, and etc.? But no, the press went along with it, and I blame the press as well.
Well, the media doesn't know yet either, so we don't know. I can't blame the media yet, because they don't have the evidence. They never searched for the evidence.
Yeah, exactly, Paul, and that's why I blame them, because they never searched for the evidence.
Yeah, they
automatically said this is the guilty party.
Blame has got to be put on the LAPD and then and now, and the district attorneys that were involved in framing Sirhan and sending him to the gas chamber. That's where the blame ought to be. The media has its own deal and is not really capable of understanding this or finding the evidence, and they don't know the evidence. So let's work with the media as we go forward in dealing with Sirhan's parole and getting him out of prison, but also dealing with the facts of the case that there was a second gunman involved. That's where we ought to concentrate, not on the media, other people. We got to concentrate on the LAPD and the district attorney who were responsible for this.
Absolutely.
They nearly killed Sirhan.
And well, you know, we look back at Special Unit Senator, which is just like the Warren Report. They're such dubious investigations. You really, I would be shocked if anybody, LAPD, look at their track record. I mean, you live out there, but I just know what I've heard of them. But so I think we need to hope that maybe a politician has the courage to do it. But I don't know. Would that ever be a popular choice, especially with a recall election coming up? I don't know. You're the guy that sets Sirhan free, and you know, most of the public not really understanding the issues.
Well, if Newsom loses, what would he have if he loses the challenge?
Well, that's true. Yeah,
that might be Sirhan's best chance, because his political career is almost over if he loses.
I know the lead candidate against Newsom at this point is not somebody I would rely on to do anything for Saran.
No, I don't think so.
Nor would I. But I'm just saying if Newsom lost and had to leave office, it might be Sirhan's only chance of parole.
The problem with Newsom is he's going to be listening to both sides of this. Mm-hmm. That's where we got, you know, Bobby's got a really good letter into Newsom, but what's Joe going to do? What's Kerry going to do in terms of Newsom? That's our dilemma and our problem at this point.
Well, maybe somebody should send a FedEx package to Newsom, and in that package it should be the autopsy report, and say, please read before you make your decision.
That's not good enough, Lori.
I know.
We've got to get the murder case against Sirhan and sending him to the gas chamber. That's the case, I know the Noguchi report is important in this thing, but that's not the end all. The end all is to get the evidence that Sirhan did not do it and a second gunman did.
I hear you, but at this point right now, Sirhan wants to be paroled and should be paroled. And if he is paroled, it would only help us to proceed with finding out.
He'd have a better chance if the truth were known about the second gunman.
Correct.
We're dealing with a governor who's, to me, is not as qualified as I would want him to be about dealing with. But what's he going to do if Joe and Kerry present a case like Bobby Kennedy did? Is he going to remain neutral? Is he going to agree with Bobby, or is he going to agree with Joe and Kerry?
Well, unfortunately, I think that since only two of the nine children spoke out, he's going to go with the majority.
Laurie, now what I understand now, Sirhan is
three Kennedys spoken out. Laurie.
Well, Kathleen did not speak out at the parole.
No, meeting. I'm talking about Bobby Three.
Okay. I did not know that. Okay.
He's now having a third baby who's going to be known as Bobby Five. That's the way Bobby Four is counting these days. Bobby Three is counting these days.
But as I understand it, Sirhan has never deviated. He still says that he doesn't remember what happens, right? That after the girl talked to him, that's it.
Correct.
Okay, so he's not deviated from the story. So there's a question here. Does Sirhan have to confess in order to complete the parole process?
He has to show remorse. Okay. And he did that in his parole. And if you look at what was said, Angela Berry, his parole attorney, coaxed him very well. Sirhan has always admitted to being there. He's always admitted to having his gun. He's always admitted that he wished he hadn't been there and that he takes responsibility. Does he have any recollection of shooting the senator? No, he does not. And even after 72 hours or so with Dan Brown hypnotizing him, you could only get to a certain point and then you couldn't get any further. And I know...
When he first said he shot Robert Kennedy, it was in the trial, and he was responding to a psychiatric issue being raised by Cooper, his own lawyer. He was angry at that point. But there are a couple of interviews he did with media people where he admitted doing it.
Paul, at his trial, he had an outburst, and he said that he had...
That's what I just said.
Yeah, 20 years of forethought. Well, he was 24 years old at the time of his trial. So at
He was angry at his lawyer, Cooper, for talking about psychiatric...
California has used that statement against him and said that since he admitted his guilt... Well, how could somebody at the age of four plot to kill Senator Kennedy when Sirhan was four was
you're getting off the issue.
Well, I'm just saying that they're using Sirhan's so-called confession in court when he was angry with his
that's
lawyer.
That's what I was just. He didn't.
That's what I'm saying. But he said
it was only anger at that point at his lawyers.
But
let's simplify it.
He will not let it drop, and they say that he admitted killing him out of that anger burst.
Yeah, that's what we said.
And it's absurd.
That's not a big issue right now.
Well, according to California, he admitted his guilt. And that David Frost interview.
He admitted guilt on a couple of
David Frost
one with a guy from England.
Yeah,
forget David his name.
And what most people don't realize is that when Sirhan gave that interview to David Frost, the attorney received $50,000.
I think his lack of memory is a defensive kind of position that he had to take with all the things that were happening to him in the prison and around him, and that he was not getting good representation.
I think his lack of memory is truly a lack of memory. But
why did he say he did it when he talked to two different people in the media?
Again, I'm telling you the David Frost interview, his attorney, Lou McKeska, got $50,000 for that interview. If I had represented Sirhan at that time, I never would have let that interview go. Sirhan gave two interviews. Look at the first interview.
Let's get back to the issues that we're dealing with today, that Sirhan is not guilty, that there was a second gunman, and that we've got to make that issue public. And we've got to make that issue with the governor.
And I agree. But whether or not people accept that, right now, let's focus on this man's been behind bars for 53 years, and he deserves, as a human being, to be treated as a human being and to be released.
Lori, you keep repeating that, but the important thing is we got to make the case of the second gunman did it, and Sirhan didn't and couldn't have done it based upon the forensics.
Paul, I agree with you. But right now, we've got 120 days.
His lawyers have never banged at that issue. Fortunately, we got lawyers who are actually dealing with different issues. They're not dealing with those issues yet. They're dealing with issues about age and health and that sort of thing, and his present attitudes. Those lawyers have not made the case, as you and Pepper didn't, that he couldn't and didn't do it, that second gunman.
I beg to differ. I tried, and we did do a case on actual innocence, and the DA of California said that we showed the possibility of a second shooter, but didn't show who it was, and we showed that there was a possibility.
There was no possibility here. We're talking about somebody who actually did, not a possibility.
But I'm telling you what the state of California said. They admitted that we showed that there was a possibility.
I hate to interrupt, guys, because we're running out of time, and I want to just briefly ask both of you, what Are you planning to do anything specifically, Paul? Are you planning to lobby anyone or Lori? And what can the public do? Is there any? Can they write to the governor? What can they do to try to help Sirhan?
We've got to get together with current lawyers, his attorneys now, with Bobby, with and others in the family to work out a strategy to deal with the governor and secondly with the case against the second gunman. That's what we've got to do.
How about you, Lori? What do you think?
Right now, I think that since Angela Berry is the attorney and we have she has 120 days before the parole hearing is decided, I don't think any actions can be taken because I think it would hurt Sirhan. Do I think the governor's going to grant him parole? No. But after that 120 days, am I willing to start again and try to show that he's innocent? Of course. I didn't do this for money, fame, or anything because I've got none of those. Money's come out of my pocket. I honestly believe that he is innocent.
Our job from right now, and it has been and will continue to be, to try to identify the second gunman and to prove that Sirhan was not guilty of the murder. That's today. It's tomorrow. It's not 120 days from now with working and or working with the governor. We've got to make the case that Sirhan didn't do it and the second gunman did. That should be first on the agenda, not any other issue.
Well, absolutely. Well, I'm in agreement with you, and I know most of the audience is too. We have to get to break now, but Paul Schrade, thank you so much, sir. It's an honor to talk with you. Your courageous work for so long on behalf of workers, and then obviously on behalf of the truth in this case, Lori Dusek, thank you very much for coming
on
the show.
And my hat's off to Paul. Paul has been working for years on this case.
Absolutely.
And you've done good work too, and it's too bad we aren't further down the road.
Yeah, well, we'll keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best. Thanks so much for joining us, Paul Schrade and Lori Dusek. We'll be right back after these words.
Hi, this is Ron Paul. You're listening to The Donald Jeffrey Show.
In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight from my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Revelation through conversation.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Hi there, this is John Barber, and you're listening to the most informed man in America, my friend, fellow author, and raconteur, the great Donald Jeffries Show.
Chili.com.
Revelation through conversation. You are listening to The Donald Jeffries Show.
And welcome back to The Donald Jeffries Show. I hope you guys liked it. What I thought was a very intriguing discussion between 96-year-old Paul Schrade. In case you didn't catch that, very powerful sounding 96-year-old, I must say. That's just incredible. In fact, we were talking before off the air, and he actually is a year older than Robert F. Kennedy would be if he were alive today. So consider that. That's how connected he is to history, and just wonderful, a wonderful gift that he has, still is able to be so clear-headed and focused and argue about what he believes in. So anyway, we're going to open up the phone lines now, so I'd love to hear from you. So feel free to call 319-527-5016. Again, the number is 319-527-5016. So as I, you know, as I'm talking to about this, you know, one of the things I write a lot about is the Kennedy family. They fascinate me, and I'm forever, you know, baffled by their attitude sometimes. That's why RFK Jr. really is just so different than most of them. And as, if you've read my book, Hidden History, you know JFK Jr. was different too. I believe that's why he was killed. He had, behind the scenes, he had a quest to find out who killed his father, and I think his plane crash was just another Kennedy assassination. But outside of those two, you can see more often it's been the Joe Jr., Joe the Third, who was a former very nondescript congressman. He was in Congress for quite a while from Massachusetts, and he really did nothing of note when he was in there. And Kerry Kennedy, who was married to Andrew Cuomo, never let it be said. So I kind of might question her judgment right there. And I'm Rory Kennedy, who I am very disappointed in, because Rory Kennedy was it's an excellent documentarian and one of the best ones out there. And she made two really great documentaries. She made a great one about her mother, but she made two great ones about the people of Appalachia, who really are probably the poorest people in America that have been forgotten by most. And she was inspired to do so because her father really made I think Robert F. Kennedy was the last president to campaign really, you know, against poverty. Let's do something about this before it got wrapped up in racial politics, which is what it is now. It just doesn't. Nobody really talks about the poor unless they're trying to make a racial issue out of it. RFK went to Appalachia, which is largely white and is probably the poorest area in America, and he made that part of his campaign. And you know, I just think, you know, that was what attracted me to him as a little kid. He was my, you know, I wasn't old enough. I was only 7 when JFK was killed, so I wasn't really old enough to understand him politically. But I was 11 when RFK died, and I was already becoming politically aware, and I could already understand the attraction that he held as a politician. So, but it's a big first step. You know, Sirhan being recommended for parole is something none of us expected, as you could tell from Lori, certainly. She was on my show last year, and I don't think either one of us thought there was any chance of this happening. So, and I don't know if Paul Schrade ever thought he'd live to see something like this. So let's hope that maybe the right thing gets done. But unfortunately, to do it the right way, you have to focus on the evidence and show that, you know, and again, I covered the RFK assassination extensively in Hidden History, all the basic elements of, you know, why it's, I'm not sure why Paul objected so much to the word conspiracy, but you know, a second gunman, you know, by you know, in and of itself indicates conspiracy. So but just looking at the Kennedy family, talked about she was astonished. Lori was astonished at Kerry Kennedy heading the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Human Rights and not fighting for this. But it's really, unfortunately, outside of RFK Jr., this generation of Kennedys have not been profiles in courage. So let's see. Okay, we have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air. Caller?
Hello, this is Jimmy James. Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Jimmy James, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good.
How are you?
Good. Great show. Talk about topical.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Do you just want to talk about that, or what's on your mind?
Well, you were mentioning Appalachia. My mom grew up in West Virginia, and mm-hmm. of course, her and all of her sisters went to see JFK when he made his trip. And then years later, they went and seen RFK when he made his trip to West Virginia. You know, they say a lot of times.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, you hear people sometimes saying that the mafia had something to do with JFK winning the primary in West Virginia. And it's not true. The people loved him. The people loved him.
Absolutely. That's part of the – and RFK Jr.'s book, which Paul Schrade alluded to, is Family Values. And it's a good book, and I urge you to read it. But I wrote about a lot of that stuff in Hidden History, and I was influenced by, you know, Jim DiEugenio, who wrote an excellent article years ago called The Posthumous Assassination of John F. Kennedy. And he goes over a lot of these myths. And RFK Jr. really delved into the mafia thing, which is ridiculous. And it's based on the same kind of myths that old Joe Kennedy was a bootlegger. And it's been repeated so many times, people just accept that there is no evidence for that at all. These kind of things were made up by people. They almost always go to mafia sources or CIA sources, as RFK Jr. wrote about in his book. And one thing I didn't know that I learned from his book is that old Joe Kennedy served on a commission during the 1950s, which was tasked to look into the intelligence agencies, specifically the CIA. And he recommended, you wonder why Alan Dulles and the CIA had a tip, he recommended at that time that the CIA be stripped of all of its power except intelligence gathering. So they had good reason to.
Well, yeah, like you said, it's amazing, the character assassination of John F. Kennedy. I mean, I've watched, you know, documentaries, films about the man, and you'll hear people, oh, I love JFK. He was one of my best friends. He was dangerous and on drugs, and he was having sex with 100 women. I'm like, and this guy's a friend?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, come on.
Well, and Seymour Hersh, as is pointed out in the chat room, Seymour Hersh, who's done great work, and in many ways he's one of the few investigative reporters we have, but he wrote really a very damaging book that I think took and same thing with Noam Chomsky, who is really good on a lot of issues, but he's not good at anything, you know, conspiratorial. He, he believes the official story of 9/11, and he doesn't care who killed JFK. He'll come out and say, he said nothing changed in our Vietnam policy. So, unfortunately, that's – and a lot of people buy into it. And I've pointed out and I've written extensively how the left hates the Kennedys. I just found a quote from Bernie Sanders back in the day of, you know, blasting President Kennedy. Dan Rostenkowski, the Democratic congressman, had horrible things to say about the Kennedys. And they match what I wrote about in Hidden History from Malcolm X and William Kunstler, who was the lawyer for the Chicago 8. You just look at the quotes they have on the record. The left hates the Kennedys, and they treat them unlike anybody else in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, they really do. Even Truman, for that matter, didn't like Kennedy.
No, Truman hated him. Eleanor Roosevelt hated him, and because they hated the old man. Old Joe Kennedy, all those people hated him. Winston Churchill, FDR, Truman, Eleanor Roosevelt, and they felt the same way about the kids. You know, they didn't trust him.
Well, it's
weird. Oh, do you
have
anything?
That's the way it goes, though. Just going to say that's usually the way it goes, though. The guy that the people like, the establishment don't like. That sounds about right.
Yeah, that's the truth. You know, nobody, you know, they don't want anybody that's for the people. And I think that's why there's, you know, it's not any accident that people like Huey Long and John F. Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, that people like that end up being assassinated, because they're representing the people. And obviously our leaders don't want that. They don't want any kind of populism out there.
Nope. They prefer chaos.
Yep, order out of chaos. Well, anything else?
Well, that's it. Great show, Mr. Dunn.
Well, I appreciate you calling. I appreciate your support. And, you know, keep listening. Tell everybody else about it, too. Pass the word on, please.
Oh, for sure.
Thank you. Appreciate it. So anyhow, that's so we when you talk about the Kennedy, and I'm writing Hidden History 3 now, and I'm studying going back into the Kennedy family more. And I'm getting a message here, and again, I'm just astonished again how the establishment. I read about it just came out the other day. A woman that was supposedly JFK's mistress back in 1958, starting when he was married, is just breaking her silence now, and coming out over 60 years later, and she's doing it because she wants to empower women. Who are giving in to men when there's a power imbalance? And where were these people? There was nothing, because JFK, whatever you want to say, but even if all the alleged affairs are true, a lot of them were with allegedly movie stars, Marilyn Monroe, Angie Dickinson, people like that. So there was no power imbalance there. But you compare it to somebody like Bill Clinton, who was, who was hounding people like Paula Jones, who was a lowly secretary when he was the governor, Monica Lewinsky, who was a college intern. These are the people that I think there's a huge difference. But you don't hear people, the same left that blast Kennedy still. They don't say anything about Bill Clinton. They certainly aren't saying anything about Joe Biden, who's been photographed over and over again, sniffing kids' hairs and putting his hands in places on film, not to mention Hunter Biden, what may be on that laptop. Or Bill Cosby, even somebody like, or FDR. I go over FDR's, FDR was having an affair with his own cousin. There's lots of stories there they're not front and center. They are front and center with Kennedy. And I don't know why that is, other than, the fact that okay, I'm looking at the message. Okay. But at any rate, the Kennedys are on my mind because I'm working on Hidden History 3, and I would urge everybody out there, if you want to support me, one thing you can do is the paperback edition of Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776, 1963, is going to be released in October. So that's just a month away now. Has a foreword by Ron Paul. Very honored about that. Just, really flattered beyond measure. And it has an update. I wrote an updated couple chapters, so it has a little bit more material in it. My publisher, Skyhorse, after pretty much asking me for a Hidden History 3, is now telling me that, they may be backing off from some of the conspiracy stuff. So I hope it's not the cancel culture going into the publishing industry. But so they basically told me they're going to base whether or not they go for Hidden History 3, which I'm 200 and some pages into it now. It's the bulk of it is done, on whether or not how well this paperback does. Now, the hardback did well, so I'm hoping that people will support it. And so please look out there, and if you can find it in yourself to do that, buy the paperback of Crimes and Cover-Ups when it comes out. And I appreciate Chuck Ocelli's putting all my online links out there. And it's very important, especially in that book is incredibly important because it talks about how we got to where we are today. And it goes back to the founding and how, the two great principles that we fought the war for independence on are no longer apt. I mean, the consent of the governed was lost during the Civil War because, however you look at the Confederate States, and, I'm not supporting that, but however you look at it, those states no longer consented to the federal government. They didn't let them leave. So that shattered the main premise of our war for independence right there. And the other great principle behind the revolution was no taxation without representation. Now, anybody that looks at our jokers of so-called representatives and thinks that we have any representation, I think that was best reflected back in 2008 with the banker bailout, when virtually every public poll at the time showed 96-98% of the public against it. Nobody supported it except our leaders in Washington. Both your presidential candidates did. Barack Obama and John McCainiac, the leaders of both the Republicans and Democrats did in the Congress. So that's what I'm talking about. No, you know, taxation without representation. We have taxation, but we don't have representation. So, you know, basically the principles that the founders fought for are gone. And so what people need to know that. They don't know their history. I mean, that book, you know, I found out things when I was researching it. One thing I found out that, you know, people talk about, you know, I'm a free speech purist. I believe very much I'm against any kind of censorship. And I believe that if you're a civil libertarian, you stand up strongest for the beliefs you disagree with. Because if you only, you know, freedom of speech means nothing if you don't support the views of those you disagree with. And everybody, you know, you had Patrick Henry, Voltaire, that, you know, said something along the lines of, you know, I may agree with what you say, but I'll defend to my dying day. You're right to say it. Oh, that's the way I feel about it. And I've discovered while researching World War One that Woodrow Wilson, again, relying on some awful precedent set by Abraham Lincoln, threw World War One protesters like the great socialist Eugene Debs, who has not gotten his due, into jail for protesting the war. Well, obviously, a court case arose over that. You don't have the right to do that. Why you can't throw somebody in jail over that? Well, Supreme Court ruled that he did have that right. And the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, another, you know, so-called liberal who was a eugenicist like most of these guys were and are, and pro-war all the way, never met a war he didn't like, again, like most of these guys are. He wrote the in his opinion, he came up with the phrase, "You can't yell fire in a crowded theater." So people think that was always there. No, that didn't come into play until 1917, 1918, whenever that decision was. And before that time, no, but it makes sense, of course. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. The problem is he was applying that to World War One protesters. So as I said, however you look at it, Eugene Debs and all the other people protesting World War One were not yelling fire in a crowded theater. But the American people at the time, as now, they let this roll off their back. They stayed like the frog in the boiling water, and they just allowed it to happen. And that's why it's so important to study history, to see how these things happen. We crossed moral line after moral line in the sand until we got to the stage where we are today, where we're running around with masks. And keep in mind, this all of these mandates, I try to make this point repeatedly, none of these mandates are legal because none of them were passed as any kind of laws. They're just, you know, the governor passes an ordinance. Trump passed an ordinance. The governor passed. That's not the way the law is supposed to work. You know, it's supposed to originate in the legislature. They're supposed to create laws. You know, you have to wear masks. Not so. That has not happened anywhere. So people are running around, scurrying around with masks on, social distancing. How is that a law? They're doing these ridiculous things that have no – not only are insane from a common sense standpoint, but they have no basis in any kind of law. And yet we didn't get to this point accidentally. You have people that are so dumbed down and are so willing to accept authority. And these are the same people, by and large, buying this, who will buy that the establishment narrative in the RFK assassination, the JFK assassination, or 9/11 or anything else. They obey authorities, and they've got now where they have their late night comedians and people like that who will not ridicule the authorities anymore. This is not George Carlin or Bill Hicks or anybody like that or Richard Pryor. They're not ridiculing anybody that has any power. They're ridiculing you. They're ridiculing, you know, something called white supremacy, whatever that is, which can't even be proven. They're you know, riddling concepts, real or imaginary. They're not poking holes in any kind of real powerful figures, or they're not calling out authority like, you know, Lenny Bruce would in his day, certainly George Carlin would. I can't imagine what George Carlin would think of today. He would be considered a right wing extremist, I'm sure, because he'd be reacting to the woke authoritarianism. But we didn't get there by accident again, because we bought ridiculous narrative after ridiculous narrative. The majority of the people in every one of those errors the Don Jeffries of the world, you know, the so-called conspiracy theorists that were ranting and raving. And I was ranting and raving going back to the 70s, you know, in my little wherever I could at work and my family, whatever. So they, you know, they've heard me do this for a long time. It's not that I was necessarily trying to warn people. I think I was trying to influence people. I was trying to say, why can't you understand? You know, why don't you get it? Don't you see they're lying to you? Don't you see that makes no sense? And that's been the gist of my, my argument in my entire life is to try to get people to wake up and understand long before it became fashionable to try to wake them up. Now, a lot more people are awake, but the problem is that we are so outnumbered and there's so many more people that are asleep that are awake and that you can't wake up. You can't reason with them. You can't rationalize with them. And that is why I would have, like Lori Dusek, unfortunately, I would probably hold out very little hope for Sirhan as well, because if depending, again, we already know that how often you can you, and certainly somebody like Gavin Newsom, who has been one of the leading authoritarian figures in terms of just cracking down, and of course being caught in true hypocritical fashion, being caught violating the mask mandates and so forth himself. Okay, I'm looking at the chat room. I don't see much activity there tonight. We've had a much more active chat room. Frankly, I expected a lot more people in the chat room. I don't see some of my main people that are usually here. I thought that they would – maybe they weren't interested in RFK assassination. Citizen X says, Skyhorse distancing itself from some conspiracy. That's pretty shocking. Well, they made the comment to me that their conspiracy books aren't selling well, and I commented back that – Hidden History is still doing really well. And I don't know what Hidden History is up to now, but it's got to be close to 30,000 copies sold, which in today's market, 50 years ago would be comparable to probably 500, half a million copies. I would say something like that. They did make a deal with Simon & Schuster. Yeah, I know. And I thought that was a great thing because now I have a Simon & Schuster page, which is really cool that, you know, and that I now try to send that to people to try to impress them that, you know, I have a major publisher, but, I don't know. You're right. Simon & Schuster's not exactly been known for their – in fact, that used to be my joke. That was when I used to talk about Skyhorse. I'd say, well, you know, it's not like I'm going to get Simon & Schuster to publish me. So now I have a Simon & Schuster page for what it's worth. But and I think they may, again, just be responding to the climate we live in. We live in a very authoritarian climate. And so a freewheeling discussion of anything – is frowned upon the same way. It must be really tough to be a stand-up comedian nowadays, because you can't make fun of any. I mean, you can get in trouble so easily. Look at that guy that the host of Jeopardy. I don't even know what he did, but apparently I'm not sure what he said. Some tweets or comments on the show, and I have no idea. I used to watch Jeopardy a long time ago. I like the concept of the show, but. I have no idea. I don't, and they never say, and that's what irritates me about stories when they're attacking the people and they're basically saying, great, we canceled you, and I hate the cancel culture. There's no, give me an example of what he said. Excuse me. And why it was so bad that it warranted him losing his job. Now, I don't know, maybe, but again, I'm a free speech purist, so I don't understand this stuff. You know, yeah, I guess if you advocate, but even if you advocated mass murder or something, if it's a private conversation, I don't. It's very troubling to me that people can, you know, are so willing to accept that and say, well, you can't say that. Why can't you say that? I mean, free speech is free speech. You can't put an asterisk on it. But unfortunately, in World War I, we already put the first asterisk on it. And it was led by the great liberal Oliver Wendell Holmes when, he said, no, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. So if they can, you know, attribute protest of World War I to yelling fire in a crowded theater, what can't they can? They can easily yell, you know, protest over Oswald doing it, you know, protesting the official version of the JFK assassination. They can easily say that is yelling fire in a crowded theater. It's just as much as protesting World War I was. So this is a very slippery slope, a dangerous territory that we've entered there. But again, most people, and I know I'm outnumbered, man. I look around, I look at my own family, I look at friends, and I know how outnumbered I am, and It's very disillusioning because, I mean, I knew we were outnumbered. I just didn't know we were quite outnumbered by this much. It's like, really, this, you know, this, really, these, we have that many people outnumbering us. It's very, you know, it's very distressing, you know, to think that, that you have such an uphill battle because these people, there's no number. You can't even equate how hard it is to battle that many people. You need to have power in numbers. And, you know, if it's one person arguing against, there's one of us for every 100 of them, which is probably about what the ratio it is. You can see it's an uphill battle. If we were playing some kind of a sporting event, would we have much chance of winning? I don't think so. So, but at any rate, so that's the, you know, so my book, Crimes and Cover-Ups, again, if you want to support me, please look to buy the paperback of that. Cause that, you know, other than that, I will probably have to go to, I'm not going to go to Try and Day again. And realistically speaking, there are three publishers that are receptive to the kinds of material I write, nonfiction-wise. And by far, Skyhorse is the biggest. There's Try and Day, which published Bullyocracy, and I don't think I'll be going back to them. And there's Feral House, which the guy who I knew, the one-man, kind of a one-man outfit there who published some good stuff, he died. Last year, the year before that, and so I guess they're still in big, but I don't, you know, I don't even know how organized they are or anything. So probably what I would do is go the self-publishing route, or I've you know, my buddy, my friend who's starting to publish, probably I would have him do it, but that would be my and that's probably how I'm going to go with the book on the plandemic, which I kind of put on hold because I wanted to get Hidden History out there first, but that, you know, you may have to go with other options. Okay. Feral House is highly active. Well, somebody else must have taken them over because like, I forget the guy's name that died. Well, that's good. Well, they're an option, I guess. But also, you know, for those of us who, like, you know, I said, Hidden History is sold. That's when I was talking to Skyhorse, and they said conspiracy books haven't sold. I said, well, Hidden History is still selling really well. And I said, yeah, I don't know. And I compared it to it's 9-1 book. It needs to be out by 10. Yeah, well, it's the book is I think it's right now it's October 19th or something like that. I saw on Amazon. But that, you know, it sometimes it changes a little bit, but it should be around that. But just to, you know, by comparison, I read an article, Vanity Fair or somewhere, just, you know, blasting Skyhorse from a couple year or two ago, and of course they didn't mention me, but they mentioned some of the high profile authors, and like Jesse Ventura, Oliver Stone, people like that. They mentioned Roger Stone, who it revealed his book about the 2016 campaign, Making of the President or something, that it had sold like 20,000 copies or something. And again, Hidden History sold more than that. And they'd published Woody Allen's book. And Woody Allen's book sold 15,000 copies, according to this article. Again, so Hidden History sold about twice that amount. So I'm just looking at how it's done, you know, compared to some pretty big names. So Chelsea says Joseph L. Flatley was just published at the Feral House. He'd been a guest on September 6th. Oh, cool. Well, that's, yeah. And I think that's, realistically, that's, well, it's nice to know that they're active. And maybe they are, maybe that is something I could pursue. I don't know. But I may, again, just go if I can't get, because I mean, you don't make any, and that's what's so frustrating. Even though Hidden History has done, I think, really much better than I ever thought. And in today's market, that's about as good as you can expect a book to do. Even so, I've made very little money on it. That's why my book on showbiz that's coming out November 1st is the last target date I heard on Borrowed Fame. I can relate so much to all the entertainers I communicated with because they got so little of the fruits of their labor, and it's the artist that just never does. It's the royalty rates are so small. Jay says there's some published on the dissident, right? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are. But I don't – again, my problem is I would have the same problem with someone on the right and then I have, you know, and some people on the left is that they they would object to certainly the people on the dissident right. Most of them are not going to, especially if it's a Hidden History 3 kind of thing. They're not going to like my take on the Kennedys, probably. And we see that in Tucker Carlson. I think Tucker Carlson, you know, just really goes about as far as the mainstream media can on some things. He talks about things that nobody else does, but he doesn't talk about any kind of conspiracy stuff. And I know he hates the Kennedys, like a lot of the, you know, it comes out whenever he talks about it. It's very obvious. And so he's definitely going to believe all the nonsense about their deaths. They probably don't have the distribution yet. Well, yeah, I mean, there's one. I wrote it down, actually. I heard, but again, it was I think it was Fox News talking about it. So, you know, I don't know. You had Regina repressed or whatever. But, I mean, I don't fall into that left-right paradigm. So it's, you know, unfortunately, my choice. And really, it shouldn't matter. It should matter if you can write. I know I can write. And of any time I've received any criticism, no one has ever, you know, said it's, you know, you just can't write. You know, I think my, you know, enemies acknowledge I can write, but it's what you're writing. And that's the problem today in the kind of cancel culture or censorship crazy world we live in. It's, you know, what are you writing? You know, that you can write it as brilliantly or wonderfully as you can, but it doesn't matter. And that's the issue that that I'm facing. So, but if I may go the same route, I have a good friend that's publishing, and he's going to publish my book on the plandemic, Masking the Truth, which I was holding back because trying to get Hidden History three out there first, because I know the book about the plandemic is going to be my most controversial book of all, and that's saying something because my books are all controversial. Okay, we have somebody in the chat. Will you find the Secret Service shooter that shot at Judy Woodruff and Ronnie? Will I find this? I don't think I can find anybody. I think you're referring to, well, Judy Woodruff originally reported that there was another gunman on the roof of the hotel there where Ronald Reagan was walking out of that day. I don't know that it was a Secret Service agent, and I read a little bit about that, but... yeah, rather just laughing at something in the chat room. But so I may go that route because I'll make a lot more money that way anyhow, certainly. And yeah, at least it gives you some options. And if you guys get a chance, I was on earlier today. I mean, I get some good platforms. I was on the David Knight Show, which I think David does some really great work. And I'm sure most of you have heard of him. He was with Alex Jones in InfoWars for a long time, and he was famously fired, or I guess earlier this year. And I think it was pretty obvious he was fired because he was criticizing Trump. You know, Alex can say what he wants. Okay, Poopo with the unique name says, what about the doorman who killed Kent Lennon and Jack Kennedy? Okay, well, there was a doorman in the Lennon assassin who had ties to anti-Castro Cubans. I don't know that he killed Lennon, and I'm not sure that I don't think he killed Jack Kennedy. But, and Hartman, I'm not sure what you're talking about. Oh, Phil Hartman? Maybe you're talking about Phil Hartman. And Phil Hartman, historian, Chuck Ocelli can appreciate this. I discovered the work of Dave McGowan through Phil Hartman because I was a long time ago, I was doing it. I always suspected something didn't sound right about the Phil Hartman's death. Just really. And I, of course, you know, Hollywood, and that's why Unbarred Fame was such a, you know, easy book for me to write because there's so many parallels between the world of show business and the world of politics. They're the two professions where you find this unbelievable numbers of unnatural deaths. That just stuff doesn't happen in other walks of life, but you find it in politics and you find it in showbiz. And so I was doing a search, internet search on Phil Hartman, and it brought me to something Dave McGowan. Yeah, I didn't know who he was at that point. And I was fascinated by the guy. I started reading and I started reading more. And I said, wow, this is, you know, we're kindred spirits here. And as it turned out, you know, I think it would have been the start of a beautiful friendship if he hadn't tragically died and suspiciously died, in my view, when he did, because we I already have found several times online I heard people had mentioned us in the same name where we had, I know Maria Heller, our friend, she has compared me to him, which is a great compliment to me. And I take it that way because Dave was a fantastic writer and a fantastic mind who we lost well before our time. And years ago, I talked to the lady. It might have been the last to see Jimi Hendrix live. Yeah, another, you know, strange. And, you know, Hendrix, and again, I talk about this in the showbiz book. The girl he was with that night, I think, ended up jumping out of a window or dying of a drug overdose. And his manager, I think, was killed in a plane crash or something. So, yeah, there's just – there's so – again, these deaths, it's just like politics. I mean, you talk about the Clinton body count or the Bush body count or whatever. Well, it's like a Hollywood body count or, you know, just a showbiz body count because a lot of it's rock, rock-related as well. But, I mean, there's just so much out there. And – I think hopefully people will like the book, and but it's there's a lot of parallels to it. It's not really people have said, well, that's something different for you, but it's really not. First of all, I'm kind of a showbiz junkie. I'm really interested in the history of the Hollywood. And okay, John Lovett shot Waco and Brandon Lee. Maybe that old dude with the glass on Letterman back in the 80s, Larry Bud Melman. Okay. Well, Poop Hole is certainly full of in the full of wild accusations. John Lovitz shot Waco and Brandon Lee. I know John Lovitz was mad at Andy Dick over Phil Hartman. Maybe you're getting that out of that. I don't know that Larry Bud Melman ever killed anybody. He was another great guy. David Letterman plucked from obscurity. He just had like a – he was like a receptionist or something. And Larry oh, okay. Maybe you're thinking Larry Bud Melman Dwyer. Okay, Arbit Dwyer, yes. Okay, well, that sounds like an SCTV sketch, Larry Bud Melman Dwyer. But our Bud Dwyer, for those of you who don't know, famously killed himself during a live press conference. And as I wrote about this in Hidden History, I communicated with his children later. And he read what they said was a long, rambling note. This Washington Post, they published the photo of him sticking the gun in his mouth. They weren't above that, the Post and the other newspapers. They didn't quote from what they all consistently, you know, the way, you know, Tucker Carlson and other people play like sound bites from all these stations using the exact same, you know, like the Easter Bunny saw shit, you know, the exact same words over some stupid story as if they're, you know, receiving it from, you know, Conspiracy Central or something. Here's the talking points for today. Certainly isn't something you'd see a competitive free press doing, but, they all referred to it as a long rambling note. Well, the Spotlight at the time, which is a newspaper that later, after being driven out of business by the Anti-Defamation League and driven into bankruptcy, resurfaces the American Free Press, where I write regularly now. So I urge you to read my work on the American Free Press. It appears in every issue. But, of course, they've been smeared as anti-Semitic. And the Spotlight, doing the kind of good work they did back then, they interviewed R. Bud Dwyer's widow. They're the only ones that did, and they published. They got the long rambling note from her, and they published it. Well, the long rambling note was a detailed indictment against then sitting governor of Pennsylvania Richard Thornburgh, who went on to become Bush the Elder's attorney general. And it was just a litany of just, you know, garden variety corruption. And of course, Thornburgh reacted like the tyrant he was, where he lashed out at Dwyer and targeted him for prosecution himself through his lackeys. So Dwyer, you know, very unwisely, it wasn't, you know, obviously not a good move, but to kill yourself. But I think he thought, you know, rather naively, or, you know, certainly I couldn't agree with it, but he thought maybe this would bring attention to what he, but he didn't count on the media being as dishonest as they were, and they did not report. Unless you read the Spotlight back then, you would not know, and you read Hidden History later, you would not know what was in that long rambling note. So just kind of a backdrop on that. Citizen GX says, I just saw Jim Giugeni on Oliver Stone on Fox. Now, are you seeing that on regular Fox TV, or do you have to go to Fox Nation or on demand? I'd like to see that as well. If you can, reply in the chat room where people can see that. Is it now appearing? I can't imagine it's on Fox now in prime time, but maybe Fox On Demand or something. I'd like to see that because Diogenio claims that they were pretty fair to him. And again, if you want to know how bad the mainstream media is, Fox News is probably the closest thing. I can't see CNN or MSNBC. Again, not that they're any good, but I think Jim admits that as well, that they were there. No other network was going to give them the chance to do that. And so as bad as they are, I think, unfortunately, they're about the best we have. Okay, poop hole is now just out there. I think Paul Schaefer conspired against Harvey Pekar and Jim Belushi's choice of appearing in turn. Okay, well, I'm not sure who poop hole is, but you've livened up the chat room at least a little bit. I don't know where the regulars are. I know where Chris is, especially. And I don't know. Normally, we have a very lively chat room. Tonight's not so much. I don't know. Maybe people weren't interested in the to me. You know, we had that was a big guest. Paul Schrade is a good find, and he's certainly at 96 years old. It's amazing he's still giving interviews. So, Lori Dusek was Sirhan's lawyer for I think 16 years or something. So connected to some Max Headroom was fake and insincere. Yes, he certainly was fake. I'll give you that, Max Headroom. Okay, I was thinking we had a caller. No, it's six. Only one caller, too. But so that's, you know, so if you, I'm writing regularly, and the way you guys, if you value my work, you can try to support me in any way. I also, you know, I hate begging for money, but I, you know, I'm doing what I want, but I, you know, it pays like a McDonald's. I'm getting paid like a McDonald's worker. And so I would like to make a little more money. So I've told people, some people have contributed to my PayPal, which is under my email, which is authorisn'twriter, AUTHRJeffries@gmail.com, authorjeffries@gmail.com. So you can help that way. You can review my books. And now you, on Amazon, you don't even have to review books anymore. They let you rate them. So you can just go and give my books a good rating. Because I don't support Amazon at all. I don't like Amazon, but unfortunately, the publishing industry, I usually route people there because if, for somebody like me who's still trying to get more stuff published, it's easier if the publishers are going to look at what you have out there. And now they look at Hidden History, which again is doing really well. It's up to, you know, 340 some reviews now, which is really, really good. And they're going to see that and they're going to go, huh. You know, so the more ratings, and again, you don't have to, it used to be you had to have reviews where you had to sit down and actually rate something. You don't have to do that now. You can just simply rate it. So it couldn't be easier. It's like liking something on Facebook. That's important. The same thing with Goodreads, a little bit less, but Goodreads and Barnes & Noble. Anywhere, if you want to support me, just, you know, those don't cost anything. So that's appreciative because, again, I'm trying to, I'm doing this full time. And the more money I make at it, the easier it is for me to do better work, obviously, to conduct research and so forth. And I want to thank I'm very grateful for all the people I have. For instance, Tony Arterburn, who has been so helpful to me. He's the one that basically got, because he used to be David Knight's guest host. And very famously, when I was on Owen Schroyer, I was supposed to be on Owen Schroyer's show when Tony was guest hosting a while back, and he was going to have me on there because he's just incredibly supportive. He loves my work, and it's fantastic. I can't thank him enough for all the support. But literally 5 minutes before airtime, I'm waiting to be called into the, you know, to the virtual green room. Tony calls me on the phone and says, I've been yanked. So that is basically, you know, that was it. You know, and after the aftermath of David Knight being fired, Alex Jones, I think, suddenly found out that Tony was guest hosting for Owen Schroyer, which made no sense because he had been. But then he recognized, you know, my name from, because I had David Knight on my show. And so at any rate, Tony hasn't been back on there, although Owen Schroyer is a good friend of his and he's apparently a real nice guy. But so that's just kind of an interesting inside thing there. But, oh, there's Chris. Is leukemia possible to weaponize like the Fast McGowan case? I think McGowan's was mostly, I think it was lung cancer. Okay, he was a heavy smoker. I mean, you could see, if you watch that last interview, I think it was his last video, and anyhow, on Midnight, Caravan to Midnight, which John B. Welch, I've been on, I think, three times myself. Really interesting, powerful interview on the Boston bombings, whatever the photos and everything. Great stuff, just like his work on his website. And you could see him coughing and smoking an awful lot. So Is Poopo Judy Baker. Or maybe Fetzer. Well, yeah, I don't know who it is, but I guess he's brought a little life into the chat room, which was definitely quieter than usual tonight. So, but so you know, with between I bounce back and forth from history to present times, but we're in unprecedented times now. And again, I think it, regardless how you see it in the left or right, it's at this point it's right or wrong. And we are going in the wrong direction. If they pass this vaccine mandate, somebody like me, you know, I'm going to be able to, I could collect Social Security now. I'll probably wait till next year, but I don't know why. I don't really trust the system to be there, but I want more per month. But you have Bill Gates has already floated out the idea that let's not give Social Security benefits to the unvaccinated. So. Needless to say, that's a terrifying prospect for me to hear because I am unvaccinated. I'm going to stay unvaccinated. I'm not getting vaccinated, and it's already costing me something because I'm being ostracized by my family at large, and I know that's happening. I'm hearing from when I write about it and talk about it, I hear from other people that say, yeah, the same thing's happening to me, and this is just such a tragedy and such a shame, and it's worse than the Civil War in terms of brother versus brother, because you're seeing everybody's involved. So it's grandmother against mother and things like that. And I don't know that we can ever heal this, because it doesn't look like the answer is ever going to come. There's never going to be a final shot. It's just, no, we have to get, there's another variant's coming. Let's get another booster. And it's the side that's buying into it is not going to back down, because they're, beyond any conspiratorial stuff, they're never going to admit that the so-called conspiracy theorists were right. And that's what, I found that a lot of people just don't want to admit that we're right. Citizens, if that's on Fox Nation, okay, well, I'm not going to pay for Fox Nation. I was hoping that it would be on Fox On Demand, maybe, because I thought they said on the forums at one point that it was going to be on, right, maybe it's still a while away where they'll show it on Fox at some point, maybe in the middle of the night or something. But I pay enough for cable TV. I'm not going to pay nor for Fox Nation. Like I said, I watch Tucker Carlson because he does some good stuff, and I still have hopes of getting on his show. His producer has Survival of the Richest. They've expressed some interest, as has Laura Ingraham, who actually invited me on the show last year. And they pulled the invitation like 2 hours later. And as I understand it, I've talked to people who've been on Fox News, and I guess it's probably the other way with other channels too. But they're notorious for changing lineups constantly as news change. And that happened to me on RT. I haven't been back. I was on RT. Jesse Ventura's show several times, and Sean Stone's show. And the last couple of times, Jesse Ventura invited me back, and both times they canceled right when the Uber was going to come and pick me up, and didn't really just said, oh, well, the story's changed. We had to cover something else. I'm not so sure. I don't know, because they've never asked me back. And at this point, Jesse, who I love in many ways, he's urging everyone to get the vaccine, and I think he's a big open borders guy, so I'm not sure what we would talk about anyhow, because we're probably not on the same wavelength about a lot of things anymore. Oh, I got a caller. Okay, we're getting near the end. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Don, it's Chris. How you doing?
Hey, Chris, how's it going? We missed you earlier. The chat room wasn't hopping like it usually is.
I was listening. I just I feel a little bit under the weather. No, it was a good show. I just had a question for you, because I didn't do any research on it, but do you think it's possible that besides, like, Dave McGowan's the fast-acting cancer type thing, the Jack Ruby type thing,
right?
It's probably possible that they weaponized, other things like lymphoma and leukemia, right?
I certainly don't think that's beyond their capability. And, Jack Ruby himself, he supposedly in the letter that, again, of course, they claim is a forgery or whatever, but the letter was smuggled out of prison. I think Penn Jones had it. He made that allegation that they had injected him with cancer cells. And so I don't have any doubt that that can happen. And I think maybe Chuck could answer that too. I think Dave is Dave's family, I believe, believes that there was something.
At least trying to get you. Yeah, I've been trying to get Craig to contact you or something, because when he was on your show with Maria, he was kind of getting into like the details, but his connection kept breaking up, and it drove me nuts, because he later on he ended up like telling me a little bit more like on Facebook about it. And I think people should know. You know?
Yeah, they should. But I don't know what's going on with Craig. He, for a while, he was really buying into the hysteria. He got in arguments with me and my supporters early on when I was writing.
Yeah, he's beyond that, though. No, I know.
Oh, he's beyond?
I know
okay.
Coming from. Like, I was kind of, stepped away from the COVID thing, too, because, like, I had a relative and all that. But then that kind of subsided, and I think Craig kind of came to his wits, too. And plus, he was taking care of his elderly parents.
Right.
So. Right. So yeah, I can see why he was out of whack and stuff, but I think he's back on board, and I guess Alyssa is going to put out one of Dave's books again with that title that you and John Barber were talking about.
Stole John Barber's title, Myth America. Yeah.
Something like that. But Craig. Me personally, I would love to hear Craig's story, like with his voice, because that was just Facebook stuff. But he had quite the thing to
tell.
And he had mentioned. Sorry.
No, we may have to have him back on, because I had him, on TFR, and his Skype connection was horrible. So maybe it would be better here.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah,
because it was a good show.
And he actually had mentioned that one of the last interviews that Dave did on video was with a an Australian woman. And they seemed to have like a good rapport and everything during the interview, but Craig was kind of mentioning that he kind of thinks that maybe she had something to do with it too. And I won't say the name of the woman, but
yeah, I remember him saying,
it was rather odd.
Yeah, I remember him saying, and that's, when you get into the world and you're talking about the kind of stuff Dave was, I guess, anything is possible. You can't help but be paranoid. And it's,
Why do you think they let him live on for so long, though? Because he was, like, spot on with, like, just about everything, like, in my opinion.
Well, he was.
Why was he allowed to live that
Well,
long?
I think he did,
but yeah. He suffered, though.
Well, they can't kill everybody. I think they just pick and choose, I guess. I mean, I don't.
Yeah, but, he only really got prominence, really, on a larger scale with Weird Scenes, which was, like, way after his research began. Like, they could have taken him out, like, right after his 9/11, the first 9/11 truther thing,
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm all over the place.
But I think I think we got to run here because it's almost out of time. But Chris,
I understand.
I
was listening.
Well, I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Number one researcher, Chris, I can't thank you enough.
Your work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for calling. Thanks
all right. Well, I'll talk to you soon.
We'll be talking. Thank you, Chris. So I think we're just about out of time. But again, I thank everybody for listening. I thank the callers and people in the chat room. And I'll be listening next week when I think we're going to have a tribute to Maria Heller's show. We have to talk to Chuck and Maria about it. But anyhow, as always, keep sending forth those tiny ripples of hope, which is a more appropriate analogy than ever, given the Sirhan situation and the subject matter tonight with RFK. And keep listening to the Donald Jeffrey Show. Appreciate you. Thank you.